Now we're going to turn our attention to the Word of God and read together in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 27, verses 45 to 54, which is around page 999 of the church Bibles that you'll find underneath the seats that are in front of you. Matthew chapter 27 from verse 45. Now, in a sense, it might feel to some folks as though we're stepping back here, because 2 weeks ago was Easter Sunday when we celebrated the resurrection from the dead, whereas this picks up Matthew's Gospel in chapter 27 back on Good Friday and describes the time when Jesus died. And there's a couple of reasons for that, partly because it's just following the pattern of readings that we have been pursuing in Partick Trinity over a couple of months, working through this bit of Matthew's Gospel from the beginning of chapter 26, just looking a paragraph at a time at what Matthew was describing. And this is the stage that we'd got to. If our timing had been slightly better, we might have finished off the death of Jesus before Easter and been able to do the resurrection afterwards. But it's more important, I think, that we read the full story properly rather than that we meet these kind of artificial deadlines. So that's one reason. It's simply the next passage in the book, and that's the way we do it here. But another reason why it's good to read this passage now is because the death of Christ is right at the heart of our Christian faith all the time. It's not a once-a-year phenomenon to put in your diary and say, I'll think about it then. Paul said, I preached Christ crucified. And by that, he didn't mean I preach the gospel once a year and do nothing the rest of the time. He meant I preach that all the time. So, words that are of eternal significance, we read together now from Matthew's Gospel in chapter 27 in verse 45. It follows Jesus' arrest, his trial by the Jews at the Sanhedrin, who convicted him of blasphemy, his trial by Pilate, who condemned him to death for political reasons rather than anything else, his mockery by the soldiers in the barracks in secret, and then his being taken out through the streets of Jerusalem to the place called Golgotha, where they put him to death and they mocked him. Person after person, passers-by and priests and everyone around came and made fun of Jesus as he hung there in agony. Probably he was crucified about 9 o'clock in the morning, and so he hung there for those 3 hours in pain. And then this happened in the middle of the day, verse 45. From noon until 3 in the afternoon, darkness came over all the land. And about 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani. Aramaic words, which mean, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing there heard this, they said, he is calling Elijah. And immediately one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with vine vinegar and put it in a staff and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split, and the tombs broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life, and they came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, surely he was the Son of God. Amen. And I pray that God will follow with his blessing this reading from his word. Just in the run-up to Easter, one of my colleagues shared with me and with some others the fact that there were some aspects of our Christian Easter celebrations that he didn't like, he wasn't comfortable with. And he was thinking in particular of Good Friday services because, he said, so often preachers try to explain the crucifixion. And his perspective was that the story, of which we've just read a part, was told to be marveled at, to absorb us, to be wondered at, to be meditated upon, to move us, perhaps even to tears, but not to be taken apart and analyzed. Some folks I know have been watching on TV the series in which James May takes old bits of machinery apart. I think it was a lawnmower the first week. Took it apart and put it back together to see how it worked. And I think my colleague was saying sometimes on Good Friday we seem to treat the Easter story like that. We take it apart and analyze the pieces to see how it works. When the truth is that the drama unfolding in front of us is greater than the sum of its parts. And I've got a lot of sympathy with that. I'm sure you have too, because the story of Christ's death is a real flesh and blood event. It happened. It unfolded in the streets of Jerusalem and the hills outside the town where genuine human emotion was outpoured along with the blood and the sweat and the tears. And we shouldn't like to allow academic theologians to reduce that to a blackboard in front of a class full of students and turn it into a series of doctrinal propositions on which people could be examined or by which their orthodoxy could be tested. To do that would be a bit like saying, what matters about, I don't know what your favorite cake is that you might buy from the shops, but what matters is the list of ingredients in the side of the packet. And you buy the cake and you study the ingredients and think you know the cake, without ever having opened the packet and tasted it. The story is greater than the sum of the parts. But having said that, I think you will agree with me that there are things in this story which are there to be wondered at and meditated about. There are a whole host of questions that we would want to ask. Why did Jesus do these things or speak those words? And why did God cause these things to happen, or at least allow them to happen? And as we read in this case Matthew's record of the events that actually took place, we ask ourselves, why did he record that particular detail? Perhaps other things were said or other people were there, but Matthew selected particular bits. And we understand, I think, that this story is told not just to impress us at the time, the way you might go to the cinema and watch a story on the screen and get totally absorbed in it, and then go out afterwards for coffee and then go home and hang up the washing and go to bed and read a book. It's not just that. It's here to make a lasting difference to us. Matthew wants to turn inquirers into disciples of Jesus. So what I hope that we can do this morning, without totally dismantling the story, is reflect together on some of the things that happened and some of the questions that I believe Matthew really wants us to ask. And the first question is this: why the darkness? It tells us that from noon until 3 in the afternoon, darkness came over the whole land. Why that darkness in the middle of the day? Some folks have suggested it might have been an eclipse. You know, when the moon gets between, I don't know how an eclipse works, but something gets between us and the sun and it all goes dark. perhaps that's what happened. Astronomers tell me, and I've just displayed my astronomical ignorance, but astronomers tell me that's unlikely because Passover, when Jesus died, happens at the full moon, and at that time you don't get eclipses. So that seems unlikely. Other folks have suggested that maybe there was a sandstorm or a dust storm whipped up from the desert, or maybe just clouds gathered over the sun. Which also sounds unlikely. I don't think Matthew would have described that as darkness. And I think if the weather had just changed and it got a bit cloudy, he might not have bothered putting that into his story. So it's probably better to see what Matthew intends here is that supernatural darkness has coincided with the death of Christ. That just as at other significant moments in the Bible story, like when Moses parted the waters of the Red Sea or Elijah called down fire from heaven, so here God did something out of the ordinary that by its very nature defies explanation, and that's the point. And so the question is not how did God make this happen, but why? What is this supernatural sign meant to show us? Now, darkness in the Bible often coincides with sin. We know, for example, that the light shines in the darkness when Jesus, the light of the world, comes into the world. So light represents the presence of God, and darkness has to do with sin or the absence of God, or with God's gathering anger, or indeed with his sadness or grief. It may be significant that in the Exodus story, do you remember how God brought his people out of Egypt in Moses' day? First of all, by threatening Pharaoh with a series of plagues, which were really a judgment on him and on Egypt for enslaving God's people and disobeying God's command to let them go. Well, the second last of the plagues with which God afflicted Egypt was darkness. You can imagine the terror of that. Before the final plague, which was the death of the firstborn, which was the one that finally persuaded Pharaoh to let God's people go, and also the plague from which God saved his people by the death of the Passover lamb, which is what is happening here as Christ dies on the cross. So perhaps the darkness here is reenacting that traumatic story of warning and judgment in the run-up to salvation. The prophet Amos, in his book, chapter 8, verses 9 to 11, talks, as many of the prophets do, about the day of the Lord, or the day of judgment. And there he says, the sovereign Lord declares, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. I will turn your religious festivals into mourning and all your singing into weeping. And I will make that time like mourning for an only son, and the end of it like a bitter day. Matthew, you probably know this, throughout his gospel is fond of quoting Old Testament prophecy to show how Christ's coming fulfills what was required. And we can see so much of those words, so many of those words, coming to their fulfillment here. So in the city behind Jesus, if you like, the Passover festival is in full swing under the direction and the leadership of those men who have plotted to crucify Jesus himself. While Jesus is dying on the cross, mourned not only by his mother and his disciples, but mourned also by the father of an only son. And so the darkness expresses what God is feeling as these events unfold us. When someone dies, we might close our eyes and weep. God covers up the sun. We might feel that our world is coming to an end. Here, creation itself seems almost to be shutting down because its maker is coming to his end. So while people have been mocking and then passing on by, and the priests and the soldiers are simply getting on with their day's work, God stops. For him, everything stops at this dark and defining moment. And then at that moment, Jesus speaks out in verse 46, my God, why have you forsaken me? He doesn't whisper it. He doesn't pray it silently to God. He shouts out in a loud voice, as he has done in other parts of his gospel, a prayer that is there for other people to hear. So why these words now? What do they mean? What's their message to us? He's praying to God, and God will respond as he chooses. But why do we need to know what Jesus prayed? Especially when the words are so deeply disturbing and discouraging. Sometimes you'll hear preachers say, and there are parts of the Bible that use this message, that in our hard times of difficulty and distress, we can draw for comfort in the knowledge that Jesus has been through things like this before us. He knows what it's like for us, and he's there with us. We can endure suffering, if you like, by drawing on the strength of Christ's experience. But these words are awful, because what they say is that Christ experienced a sense of total abandonment. At his worst hour, in this bleakest of darkness, God was noted by his absence. And if you just leave them there like that, we're left to wonder, what kind of hope does that leave us when it's a dark time? If the message is that God does a runner when the going gets tough. Get through this on your own and I'll see you afterwards. It's not the message that faith wants to hear. So why these words? Well, some folks have pointed out that they are, in fact, the opening line of Psalm 22. And again, many of the Psalms in the Bible are used to put on the lips of Jesus and express what he was saying. We call them Messianic Psalms, written hundreds of years earlier, but describing his situation. So some folks have suggested that what you need to do here is read the whole of Psalm 22, which begins with these words of despair, my God, why have you forsaken me, but ends in a note of triumphant, victorious celebration. And it's these final lines of triumph that Jesus really wants to express on the cross. Well, I think there's some value in that, and we would be foolish to look only at this moment in the cross and say that's all our experience of God and neglect what comes afterwards in the happy ending. But I think it's also a bit far-fetched to say that Jesus meant us to understand exactly the opposite of what he said. Others have suggested that this is simply what Jesus felt. Who wouldn't have felt despair on the cross? And the comfort is that it's not actually true. God was there with him, because God is everywhere. He's always with us. And so in our darkness, we can, although we feel like this, overrule our feelings with our heads and talk ourselves into security in the presence of God. Well, there's maybe some truth in that as well, but I think it's difficult for us to say Jesus felt like this, but it's not actually what was happening. Because that means you and I are saying that we know better than God the Son what God himself was doing at this time. So it's better to take Jesus at his word here and recognize this as the reality of the situation. That when Jesus was dying on the cross, God was not there with him. The prophet Habakkuk tells God in a prayer in chapter 1, verse 13 of his prophecy, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. And 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21, Paul says, God made him, Jesus, who had no sin, to be sin for us. And if you take those two things together, the purity of God who cannot be with sin, and the sin carrying of Christ, then what Jesus says makes inescapable sense. Because he has taken our sin on himself, he cannot be in the presence of God. Just as in the parables Jesus has been telling us, the reluctant guests who turned down the initial invitation from the king didn't get to the banquet. They weren't allowed in later. Or the foolish virgins who didn't have extra oil for their lamps were definitively shut out of the wedding feast. Or the third worthless servant in the parable of the talents, who's buried his money instead of investing it for his master, is thrown outside into a place described as darkness and weeping and gnashing of teeth. So Jesus tells us here of the reality of what these stories describe. Not a private word of bitter regret, but a loud outspoken proclamation that because of sin, he is no longer with God. And I suspect it was that prospect, which he knew was coming, that made him weep in the Garden of Gethsemane. He knew that crucifixion was coming, and that itself is dreadful enough, but hundreds of other people in those brutal Roman days also endured crucifixion. But to suffer, and to know that in your suffering you are God forsaken, is a literal description of the depths of hell. And that is where Jesus is on the cross. My God has forsaken me. Because that's what sin does. And then from the depths of this trauma, we suddenly find ourselves almost in the realm of farce and chaos, the apparent digression into a cup of sour wine or wine vinegar for Jesus, and a confusion over the possible coming of Elijah. That's why Matthew quotes Jesus speaking in the original Aramaic language that he uses, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani. That's the words that Jesus would originally have spoken to show how this confusion arose. So this question, as I said, why in the heights of this drama do we suddenly find ourselves talking about a glass of wine and the coming of Elijah? And Matthew goes out of his way to explain the confusion to us. Every other word that Jesus originally spoke in Aramaic or Hebrew, he translates into Greek, the language in which he wrote the gospel. But he preserves the original, and our English translations do the same. Eli, Eli, my God, which could easily be mistaken for Elias, Elias, Elijah. So that explains how the confusion arose. But why relate this confusion at all? Well, I think the significance is this, that if they had heard Jesus correctly, and he was now asking Elijah for help, it would be a very sudden change of tack for Jesus. Up till now, he's expressed God confidence and absolute faith. He has walked with his eyes open to the cross, and he has allowed, even arranged, for this to happen. If all of a sudden in his dying moments he cries out to Elijah for help, and there were traditional Jewish superstitions at the time that might have caused a desperate man to do that, it means that Jesus has abandoned his faith. they're experiencing this God-forsakenness. Instead of accepting it, he despairs and panics from confident faith to absolute disaster. And that appearance of plight that touched his heart moves at least one of the folks who were standing there to try and help him. They'd been watching him suffer, but when they see him panic like this and think he is in absolute distress, at least one of them tries to ease his pain with some wine. So what Matthew is doing here is trying to show us that that is, in fact, a complete misunderstanding. And the way he does that, which unfortunately hasn't survived in our translation, is by some changes in direction in the way the story is going. He uses the word but three times, not translated here, but there in the original, which helps us to understand what's happening. So the story goes like this. Jesus says, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" So he was still crying out to God, but they thought that he was crying out to Elijah. That's why some folks tried to get him some wine and the other people waited to see what was going to happen. But Jesus, Matthew turns it back again, then gave his life to God. And the way in which Matthew describes Jesus' death in verse 50 is quite deliberate. Look at what it says. It says, when Jesus cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. Now, those are not words that anybody ever before had used to describe how somebody had died, so far as we're aware. They are an unconventional and almost irrational way of describing somebody's passing. Normally, death is something that happens to us. We might say that death overtook him. But Matthew deliberately uses words to describe Jesus dying as something that he did. He gave his spirit to God. It was his choice, and he was in control of it. So we don't have a desperate, frightened man pleading for help, but one who understands all that sin costs and endures it and is determined to carry on enduring it to the full. And Matthew goes out of his way to show us that. He uses the misunderstanding to say that's so clearly not what happened. Jesus didn't look to anyone else for help because however bad it was what he understood was required. And so the curtain tears and the earth shakes and the rocks split as if the world itself is coming to an end and nature can no longer keep it together. But in the end, it turns out not to be quite the end yet, but simply a reconfiguration of the way things are. The end of exclusive Jewish faith, mediated by priests in the temple. There's now no more curtain over the most holy place, because now anyone can enter into the presence of God. You maybe know the way the temple was laid out. Right at the heart of it was a small room in which the Ark of the Covenant was kept, where once a year the high priest would go to offer sacrifice of atonement, but the curtain hung over the front of that so that no one else could get in or even see the heart of the presence of God. And now that curtain is ripped open. It says from top to bottom. If you or I had ripped the curtain open, we would have torn it from bottom to top because we could have reached the bottom, but God tore it open from top to bottom. So now anyone can enter God's presence. Or perhaps the idea is this, that just as Jesus came out of the empty tomb a few days later, here we have God himself ripping the curtain open as he makes his way out of the temple for the last time. Will not live in that house again. And the temple becomes a part of the past. From now on, it's never anything more than a historical artifact because God doesn't live there anymore. God lives with his people. And from now on, there will never again be such a thing as a holy building or a temple or a church or a place where God is specially present. And there will no more be holy days or festival occasions on which it's uniquely right and proper for people to gather in worship. And there will no longer be holy people who have some kind of insight or are some kind of channel of grace between God and the rest of the population. There is nowhere and no time where God is not, and no one left who is denied any special privileges. And that's actually deeply challenging, because almost the whole of Christian history, of which we are a part, has included a sense in which what we have tried to do is stitch that curtain back together again and hang it up somewhere so that we do have a holy place to go in and hide. And we call this room we're standing in now a sanctuary, in absolute denial of the truth that the Bible tells us here. Or holy men, or holy days, in which God is specially present. And I understand why we do that, because it gives us a sense of security. If there's a place we can go to, or a person we can consult with, or a time that we can spend in the presence of God, it gives us a sense of well-being. But actually, what that does is deny the presence of God with us the rest of the time. And that's exactly what Matthew is showing us here, that Jesus brought to an end. God came out to be with us. And here he is. Yes, as we gather in church on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. Holy day, holy place, and even holy person speaking. But holy 11 o'clock tomorrow morning in your bath, if that's where you happen to be. Because God is just as much there. And holy lunchtime with your friends, and holy Friday night in the pub, and holy wherever you are, whoever you are, the presence of God with his people. An end to exclusion and an end also to death. The earthquake not only split the rocks, but also split the tombs open. And that itself was natural enough. The tombs, as we know from Christ's burial, were caves in rock formation. So if there was an earthquake and the rocks did split, you'd expect the tombs to be split open. But what happens next is what we want to ask our questions about. When the tombs were split open, the bodies inside them came out. Now, Matthew is the only one of the gospel writer that records this incident. You know, we have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John with overlapping accounts of everything that happened during Jesus' life, and especially his death. And Matthew is the only one who tells us that dead people got up out of the tombs of Jerusalem and by the Sunday had come into the city where people saw them. And it's not a story you often hear told at Easter time, is it? Do you know why? Because we're embarrassed about it. We wish it hadn't happened. It's one of those things that even Bible-believing Christians find hard to believe. And so we'd rather go with Mark, Luke, and John and dismiss this as a flight of Matthew's fancy. It's easier to believe the story that way. But you know what? It would have been easier for Matthew to believe the story that way too. And easier for him to tell it. You can imagine him sitting writing this stuff down and thinking, oh my goodness, they'll never believe this bit. Perhaps I could just miss it out. But he doesn't. Because he knows that it happened. And he also understands why. You see, no Jewish leader would have been surprised that when Messiah came, the dead rise to life. Daniel in chapter 12 verse 2 said, multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. And that faith in the resurrection of the dead at the end of the time has been absolutely and completely carried over into our Christian faith. So Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise. And sometimes when we hear that story, and look forward to that prospect, perhaps in our times of deepest darkness or greatest distress, we say to ourselves, I can't wait for that to happen. I can't wait for Christ's return and for the end of time and for the resurrection of the dead. Do you know what Matthew is saying here? He's saying you don't need to wait because it's already happened. There's nothing more that needs to be done because Christ has completed it. And significantly, perhaps he has the tomb split open and the dead rise to life with the death of Christ on Good Friday without even waiting for Easter Sunday morning, because once Christ has died, it's finished. Christ has come. Sin has been judged on the cross and separated completely from God. And so now that the tombs have been opened, the faithful dead can rise to everlasting life because nothing else stands between them and God. And these once dead, now risen people came and showed themselves in the city so that many could see what had actually happened. But of course, they didn't stay there for long because it wasn't the city they'd come back to life to see, but the Lord. And they went to be with him forever. So you see, what Matthew is showing us here is that Christ's death is the end of time. It's finished. It's all over now. The end of time brought forward into the midst of time. And such an event could not take place and then simply have things go back to normal. Because it wasn't simply something that happened to him. That the Easter story is not about a man called Jesus, even a son of God called Jesus who died on the cross and was raised to life, and we read it or look at it or see it acted out before us like visitors to a theater. It didn't just happen to him, it happened to us. Do you know why the sky turned black for those 3 hours? It was because of my sin. That's what grieved the Father's heart. Do you know who was utterly forsaken by God? It was you and me. And do you know who needs to experience that completely, utterly hopeless despair, suffering in a God-forsaken way? We do. And then we need to feel that convulsion of the universe, that earth-shattering truth, that it is the Son of God who has died, not me, and we are not destroyed. His death banishes my sin from God's presence forever. So that even before his lifeless body is taken down off the cross, let alone placed in the tomb from which it will soon arise, even before that has happened, the grave no longer has any hold over us. So it is a truly remarkable story, but it's not just to be wondered at or thought upon or even cried over. It's there to be lived by us at first hand. My life, my death, my resurrection, marveled at and understood and believed. I pray that God will follow with his blessing this reading from his word.